The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling something pretty urgent, actually, a crisis that often happens quietly, you know, away from the headlines.
It really does.
But it impacts the very foundation of human knowledge, human identity. Mm. We're diving into Evangelia Adams' really vital work, Endangered Languages, Crisis, Knowledge, and Revitalization.
It is a crisis, definitely not just some academic exercise. And the scale. Well, the scale is hard to wrap your head around sometimes. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a language disappearing roughly every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks. Wow.
Yeah. And if that rate continues, I mean, most of the world's languages, maybe around 7,000 or so currently, they could just vanish within the next 100 years.
That statistic is just, it's genuinely horrifying. But what Adamadu does so well, I think, is she shifts how we think about it.
We tend to think of it passively, like inevitable language death, almost like, you know, an old species just naturally dying out.
Exactly. Like it's nobody's fault.
But our mission today is really to unpack her core idea that this isn't natural death at all. It's an active, systemic process. She calls it language shift.
And crucially, it's driven entirely by human choices, by policies. That framing shift is just so important. If we keep seeing it as passive, well, we won't do anything, will we?
No.
You need to understand that language loss means losing things we can never get back. We lose unique cultural identities, sure, but also centuries of knowledge, like traditional ecological knowledge, and maybe the biggest loss, cognitive diversity, different ways the human mind has evolved to, you know, organize reality itself.
Before we really dig into how that shift happens, let's talk about our guide here, Dr. Evangelia Adamu. She's a highly respected linguist, a senior researcher at the CNRS in France.
Yeah, the French National Center for Scientific Research.
Yeah.
Huge institution. And what really gives her authority, I think, is that she's not just sitting in an office theorizing. She has this amazing dual expertise.
Okay.
She's a rigorous theoretical linguist, absolutely. But she's also incredibly committed as a hands-on field researcher.
So she's out there in community.
For decades.
Yeah.
Extensive field work, especially with really complex, often marginalized communities, like Romani speakers across the Balkans. That means she gets the real-world pressures minority languages are under, like, every single day.
I imagine her own background plays into this, too. She's multilingual herself, right? Greek, French, Spanish, and several endangered languages.
Exactly. That personal experience, you know, it gives her such insight into the actual struggle, political, social, of just maintaining multilingualism when, let's face it, the global machine seems bent on flattening everything into English.
Yeah.
Or a few other big languages.
Yeah.
And that experience really shapes her ethical view that any real solution has to be ethical. It has to be community-centered. It needs to challenge that old model,
you know,
where academics just parachute in, grab data, and leave before the language disappears.
Right, the extractive model. Okay, so if the crisis is human-made, what's the core argument in endangered languages? What's the mechanism of this shift she talks about?
Well, Adam is pretty blunt about it. Language endangerment is never just random chance.
Okay.
It's fundamentally tied into bigger patterns. Globalization, this push for cultural sameness, and these, well, systematic power imbalances that actively push minority communities and their languages to the margins.
So it's political.
It's absolutely political and social. It's a failure that results in essentially linguistic poverty for everyone.
The idea that hit me hardest was language as a repository, like a storehouse. We usually just think of language as a tool, right? For talking, for business.
Like communication.
But Adamo says no, it's more like the cultural DNA of a society. It holds entire worldviews. And crucially, this traditional ecological knowledge, or tech.
And when a language dies, those whole cognitive systems just vanish. You lose the specific words, sure, but also the really nuanced grammar that shapes how people understand relationships, not just family, but relationships to the land, to the cosmos, even to time itself.
Wow.
You lose these incredibly detailed indigenous systems for managing resources sustainably. And you just can't translate that accurately, not really, into the language of the dominant culture. It doesn't fit.
And because she shows the problem is systemic, the book kind of becomes this roadmap.
Yeah, a holistic one.
She argues that these small-scale preservation efforts, like, you know, recording a few words, making a basic dictionary, they're just not enough.
Not nearly enough. The solution has to tackle the root causes. the socioeconomic drivers, the political pressures that caused the shift. And crucially, it has to empower the communities themselves to lead.
Which brings us to the sheer scale of loss again. We mentioned the numbers, over half the world's languages at risk. But what about the quality of what's lost? What does Adamo say about that?
This is where that cognitive diversity piece really comes in. She gives some amazing examples.
Like?
Okay, think about how a language structures space. Many indigenous languages, for example, they don't use relative terms like left and right the way we do.
Uh-huh.
They use absolute cardinal directions, north, south, east, west, even, for tiny movements, like inside a house.
Really? So they always know where north is?
Constantly.
Yeah.
It means speakers of those languages have this deep, ongoing awareness of their orientation in the world. It fundamentally changes how their brain processes spatial information compared to ours.
And when that language goes...
That unique cognitive setup, that way of thinking, it goes too. It's lost.
She sums it up with this metaphor that's just, it's powerful and heartbreaking. It makes the loss feel really real.
Which one?
Every elder who dies taking a language with them represents a library burned.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, the perfect, devastating way to put it. A whole library of knowledge gone.
So, okay, you mentioned this loss is human-made, but some people might push back, right? Isn't it natural for languages to evolve? Maybe some die off. Isn't it just linguistic survival of the fittest?
Yeah, the natural decline argument.
What does Adamana say to that?
She pushes back really hard on that.
Yeah.
She says this loss is not inevitable. Not at all. It's the predictable result of deliberate, sometimes quite cruel, human choices.
Huh.
Policies designed specifically to enforce uniformity.
Like what kind of policies?
Well, you have the big historical drivers, obviously. Colonialism imposing languages.
Right.
And then the rise of nationalism, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries with those really damaging one nation, one language ideologies.
Wow.
These policies actively stigmatize minority languages. They're often banned in schools, banned in government offices. People were punished for speaking them.
And globalization just piles on top of that now.
Absolutely. The economic pressure is huge. You need English or Spanish or Mandarin or whatever the dominant language is just to get ahead economically.
So parents feel pressured.
Exactly. They feel pressure to stop speaking their heritage language at home with their kids, thinking it'll give them a better chance.
Yeah.
And that just speeds up the shift dramatically.
And Adamo also looks at the smaller scale, right? Like how people actually talk.
Yeah, the micro level stuff. Yeah. Even natural things like code switching.
Right.
You know, where someone bilingual flips between two languages easily in one conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Even that can become a sign of deep trouble, of attrition, when the power dynamics are really unequal.
Mm-hmm.
The structure of the minority language starts to kind of erode because it's not being used robustly in important areas of life anymore.
Then chapter 5 brings in technology, which feels like a double-edged sword here.
Totally.
Yeah.
The internet is overwhelmingly dominated by major languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which definitely accelerates the shift for smaller languages. But Adamo points out the other side. New tools apps, digital archives, online communities, they offer this incredible potential for documenting languages quickly, globally, and maybe, just maybe, for community-led revitalization efforts, bypassing some of the old gatekeepers.
So technology is both part of the problem and potentially part of the solution.
Exactly. And that tension really sets up the crucial part of her argument, I think. The difference between just studying the problem and actually trying to solve it.
Okay, let's talk about that. This distinction she makes between documentation and revitalization, because she says they are fundamentally different things.
They absolutely are. Documentation, that's the necessary academic work. Creating a really good scientific record.
Like writing a grammar book.
Right. Writing a full grammar, building a comprehensive dictionary, recording texts, stories. It's vital for history, for research. But Adam uses this great analogy. Documentation is like preserving a pressed flower in a book.
Okay, I see. It captures the form.
Exactly. It captures its form, but it's not alive anymore.
So revitalization, then, is trying to get the flower to grow again.
That's the goal. It's the much harder social and political project of actually restoring a language to daily living use.
Meaning people actually speak it day to day?
Yes. And crucially, passing it on to the next generation. Intergenerational transmission is key. That means creating new spaces where the language can thrive in media, in schools, maybe even in local government.
And she points to examples where this has actually worked, right? When it's community-led.
Definitely. Think about the Hawaiian language renaissance, They used immersion schools really effectively to bring the language back from being almost extinct.
Wow.
Or the Māori Kushunga Reo, the language nests in New Zealand. These are basically immersion preschools run by elders who only speak Māori to the little kids.
Amazing.
And these work because the community itself demands control. They define what success looks like on their own terms. They're not just depending on outsiders or the government to save them.
Okay, so if we pull all these threads together, what are the main takeaways? The core messages Adama really wants us to get.
Okay, theme one, I'd say, is definitely power dynamics and linguistic justice.
Right.
Adama makes such a strong case that language endangerment is fundamentally a human rights issue. It's the direct result of systematic marginalization, state policies pushing for sameness. So if we actually care about justice, about civil rights, we have to care about linguistic rights, too.
Okay, that makes sense. What else?
Theme two is the deep interconnectedness of language and environment. This is huge.
The tech connection again?
Exactly. Language loss and environmental destruction often go hand in hand. They're sort of symptoms of the same exploitative worldview. And those indigenous languages hold irreplaceable knowledge, tech, about living sustainably with the environment. Knowledge we desperately need now with climate change.
Absolutely. And theme three.
Theme three circles back to the community. Community agency and self-determination. Successful revitalization has to be driven from within the community.
Not imposed from outside.
Absolutely not. Outsiders, linguists, funders, allies like us, maybe we can be partners, we can offer resources, but we can't be the saviors. The power has to lie with the community itself, reclaiming their voice, their identity.
Adam has such a way with words, doesn't she? Some really memorable lines that just stick with you. We should share a couple of those.
Yeah, she really does. My personal favorite is the one about cognitive diversity. When we lose a language, we lose a unique way of understanding the universe.
That's powerful.
It just reminds you that every single language is this incredible, unique experiment in human thought.
And then there's the one linking language to history and justice. Language revitalization is fundamentally an act of decolonization.
A way for communities to reclaim their identity and self-determination.
Yeah.
That one frames it squarely as part of a bigger struggle for self-governance. It's not just about words.
Not at all.
And maybe one more, the one that kind of flips our modern assumptions upside down.
Oh, the one about being monolingual.
Yes. The children who grow up monolingual in a world designed for multilingualism are the truly disadvantaged ones.
Wow. Yeah, that completely reframes what we think of as normal or advantageous.
It really does.
Yeah.
Turns the whole idea of monolingualism being the default or the ideal on its head.
So that's a perfect lead-in to application. How can we, you know, the people listening, actually use these ideas in our own lives?
Well, on a personal level, I think the book really encourages us to value our own linguistic heritage, whatever that might be.
Even if it's just a family dialect?
Absolutely. A fading dialect, a minority language you have ties to, or even just developing a deeper appreciation for language diversity in general. And for parents, it's a real push to think carefully about multilingual education. See, it's a huge cognitive plus for kids, not some kind of problem to avoid.
And professionally.
Correct.
For people in certain jobs.
Oh, massive implications.
Mm-hmm.
For educators, Adamo argues really strongly for multilingual education models, ones that actually value a child's home language in the classroom rather than trying to stamp it out.
Yep.
And for anyone working with diverse communities, healthcare, social work, government, it underlines the absolute necessity of practices that are sensitive to language and culture. You can't serve people well if you can't communicate effectively and respectfully.
And for just, you know, regular citizens.
Advocacy, really. Mm-hmm. Supporting local preservation efforts if they exist near you. But also just recognizing that our collective choices matter. The policies we vote for, the languages we choose to support or ignore in schools, even our daily interactions, it all adds up. We're all part of this ecosystem that either helps linguistic diversity thrive or helps extinguish it.
Yeah. For me, the biggest thing I'm taking away is that core idea. Language loss isn't some passive natural event. It's a political, social problem.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's human-made, it means humans can actually do something about it. It's solvable through collective action, shifting from just accepting it as a disaster to seeing it as an active crisis we can address that feels, well, actually kind of empowering.
That's exactly the paradigm shift Adamo offers, I think, to stop seeing multilingualism as a problem and start seeing it as this fundamental, incredibly valuable asset for society, for our resilience, for our collective knowledge.
Yeah.
The book really leaves you feeling like, okay, I could be part of the solution. I can be an advocate for this diversity, for protecting these unique libraries of human experience held within every single language.
It leaves us with that big question, doesn't it? If language really is like cultural DNA, how are we going to make sure all those unique strands survive, especially with all the pressures pushing for sameness globally?
That's the challenge she puts to all of us.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.